Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, May 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Rich Guthrie is on the line to answer your burning questions today. Our number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Richard P. Guthrie is here. Vox Pop at WAMC.org is the email address. Join us, won't you, as we discuss whips and chucks and goat suckers. I don't know what it means. He sent me an email. He said he wants to talk about... He's Richard Guthrie. If he wants to talk about chupacabras, he's going to do it. The number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Oh, it's for the birds. We'll be back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing birds today on the show, and when we do that, we welcome back resident avian superstar Rich Guthrie. Rich is retired from the New York State DEC. He's a former board member of the State Ornithological Association and the regional reviewer for the premier birding site, eBird. If you have a birding question, call us. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us, as many people have already done. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address, and we always go first come, first serve on those as well. So let's get to the show. 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie, you are the master of the early morning tease for the program with something I don't understand, and today's subject heading, whips and chucks and maybe goat suckers. Are you sniffing model glue, sir?
Hello there, Ray. Good afternoon, and thank you. Yeah, well, that's actually one of the fun corners of the bird watching world, and that is these birds, the goat suckers, a group of birds that some of us are familiar with mostly by name and perhaps even with personal experience with them. This include the whippoorwill,
yeah,
and the nighthawk. Two of those belong to a family of birds called the goat suckers.
Why do they call them goat suckers, Rich?
Well, it's an old medieval European myth or legend that the European relatives of these birds, first of all, these are very nocturnal birds.
Yeah.
So, and they're very, very hard to see during the day because they're very cryptically colored. When they don't want to be seen, they don't be seen. And when they're out at night, you can hear them for sure, but you can't really see them, especially back in the days when illumination was something of a gift. It was a mystery. Now we have spotlights and headlights and that sort of thing, but it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
But anyway, the old story is that the goat suckers used to sneak into the barn or wherever they kept the goats and sheep and stole the milk from the ewes and got themselves sort of a bad rap, certainly undeserved, but the name stuck. And so here we have in North America several species of these things called goat suckers, including the whippoorwill and the nighthawk.
Huh.
Now, with the breeding bird survey going on now, we'll talk about that a bit later, but the goat suckers are something that needs our attention because we know they're out there, but we don't know where and how many.
Right.
And they've been having a rough go of it over the last few years. Their main food is night-flying insects, those large Cecropia moths and other large insects. They have a big, wide mouth that opens up and can catch these things. But there's been a dearth of nocturnal insects,
yeah,
and there's been a disappearance of our goat-sucker populations, the whippoorwill and the nighthawk. And then the even rarer cousin is the bird called the chuck-billed widow. So there you have the whips, the chucks, and the nighthawks.
Okay. Rich Guthrie is our guest, and the number is 800-348-2551. Let's blast through a few emails here before we get to the phones. This came in quite a while back from Nancy in Canaan. Nancy says, last week I saw a black and white bird with a yellow throat sitting on a roof. I used Merlin and got an assortment of possible birds, but none of them looked quite right. I wandered off and saw on the cover of the latest Living Bird a close-up of what looked like my bird, yellow-throated warbler. Sibley's says that they are rare this far north. A couple of birders said they'd seen yellow-throated warblers. And are they moving north? That's from Nancy.
Okay, well, that's a good observation. excuse me, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
The yellow-throated warbler is sometimes... well, first of all, they're very, very rare anywhere in our listening area, including down in the Hudson or Connecticut River Valley.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, they do occur. And in fact, it was several years ago during the other breeding bird surveys, Atlas Project, that I found the first nest of yellow-throated warbler in New York State,
huh,
along the Catskill Creek in the Catskill Mountains,
okay,
of New York. Now, it could very well be. If it is, then documentation is crucial. And without the documentation, and given the significance of a sighting of that sort, it would need to be verified in order to be, you know, in order to put a stamp of approval on it. So the yellow-throated warbler. The other one that, you know, a lot of people type in the name and they think they got it is the yellow throat. Totally different species and very common. One of my favorites. In fact, the yellow throat, which is called the common yellow throat, but I certainly don't like them. Not common at all.
Yeah.
They are numerous, but I don't regard them as common. Now the so yes, if you have a yellow throated warbler anywhere within the listening area, let us know.
Okay.
I know they do occur, and some of these are overshoots that would just forgot to put on the brakes when they were migrating north to New Jersey and kept right on going.
Yeah.
But they do occur, and anything's possible. I sure would like to hear about a real yellow-throated warbler in the area.
Rich Guthrie is our guest. It's Birds Today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. The lines are completely loaded at the moment, but when you hear somebody hang up, that'll be the time to call. This email from a DJ in Mountainville, and this came in well before the show began as well. And DJ writes, I've got a difficult question for you. Every spring, I watch my favorite little birds, like phoebes, yellow warblers, chipping sparrows, to name a few, working frantically to feed a huge, noisy cowbird chick. Every spring, I see more of this and more of this. And this spring, I've had flocks of up to 20 cowbirds foraging on my lawn. And then in bold type, DJ writes, I know it's a federal crime to kill any native bird, but with so many of our migrating songbirds declining in number, has there been any discussion among ornithologists about the possibility of controlling cowbird numbers? And that's from DJ in Mountainville.
Well, yes, there's. Thanks. And there has been plenty of discussion about the effects of cowbirds on native resident bird or resident bird species.
Yeah.
And the answer to the question is no. It is still not it is still illegal to do anything with the cowbirds in the United States or Canada. So the answer to that tough question is no. One thing about the flocks of cowbirds in the yard, they are gregarious during the winter, and right about now they ought to be spreading out. There should not be any more than two or three, maybe four in any one particular area, usually consisting of one female and several males. But the hard answer to that question is nope, can't
okay
do anything.
No, but
they're still protected.
But DJ wondered if there was any way that among the ornithologists that they could move to some sort of mitigation effort.
Not easily. Because a cowbird, first of all, it is a member of the blackbird family. They are a parasite. They're a brood parasite. They lay their eggs in other birds'
yeah
nests, and the other bird raises the young as if it were their own, to the detriment, for the most part, of their own young. In some places where the cowbirds have been severely impacting a local endangered species, that's nowhere in New York, but we're talking about Michigan and Texas for
yeah
the most part, there have been measures taken under permit by the federal government to control the cowbird parasitism.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not occur in New York, and there's no avenue for relief here in New York or any of the other states outside of those that I know of.
Rich Guthrie is our guest. It's Birds Today. One more email, Rich, then we'll take a short break and hit the phones, and we'll do your update of events somewhere around our 40 break or so. This one's from Elizabeth in Ghent. And Elizabeth writes, I was thrilled to see a bald eagle yesterday sitting in a tree on a rural road here in Ghent, New York. My question concerns the other very large dark birds, about the same size as the eagle, that were nearby. Before the eagle arrived, the other birds had been eating carrion in the road, but after the eagle showed up, they were flying in circles around the spot, seemed to be giving the eagle some space. I had initially thought that the large dark birds, about five in total, were vultures, but to be honest, they were more handsome than your average vulture. Could they have been immature bald eagles? I understand that juvenile bald eagles are very dark. Thanks for your help in clearing up this mystery. That's from Elizabeth in Ghent.
Well, I'm going to say you were right the first time.
Vultures.
That those were vultures. Because here's the thing. Yes, the eagle was drawn into whatever that was the vultures were feasting on, because they, too, like to help themselves to roadside or backyard downfield carrion.
Yeah.
The vultures will give the eagle space, they reluctantly, and they do tend to circle around and hang out in the air. But young eagles, on the other hand, will not be so complacent. They will not yield to an adult eagle or any other young eagles, and is usually, in the most part, not more than two, maybe three eagles at a site, except during the winter. They can gather in numbers. But in this time of year, I'm going to say that you were right with the vultures, and the vultures aren't that unattractive. In fact, some of those young eagles can look pretty scraggly looking, but the vultures, they're sleek and graceful in the air.
Rich Guthrie is our guest. Rich, we'll take a quick break here, and then we will go to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Birds, we are just beginning. Vox Pop, it's Birds Today. Rich Guthrie is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551, and we begin in Tivoli. Coco, you're on.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Sorry. There.
Give me a moment. Hello?
Hello. You're on.
Hi. Beautiful. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Recently, a neighbor of mine has been baiting a juvenile, we think it's a red-tailed hawk, but it could be a broad-shouldered hawk that seemed to be injured and has come to roost on our block. Or not roost, I don't know. But I've been wondering if feeding this hawk will interfere with its ability to hunt for itself later on, if maybe it hasn't had a chance to learn how to do so already on its own.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. Number one, it may well be a red-tailed hawk. There is no broad-shouldered hawk. There's a broad-wing hawk and a red-shouldered hawk, just to set that aside. But when it comes to an injured hawk or any other bird, the best thing to do is to contact a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. And in New York, you can find out where there is one by going to the New York State DEC website and do a search for licensed wildlife rehabilitators. And they can give you an evaluation of what's going on with this particular bird. The idea of feeding it is not a good idea, because not that it's going to lose its ability to hunt. That's instinctive, and they'll be able to do that. But what you don't want to do is have them become too accustomed to being around people. That can lead to trouble, injury, and mainly to the bird. And also, I don't know what you've been, what the person may have been feeding this hawk, but a lot of stuff that people think birds like, birds don't. They may eat it out of desperation, but it's not the best for them. So I would go back and check with a rehabilitator, and take an evaluation from that perspective and see if there's any intervention that may be necessary.
All right, Coco, thanks for the call. Rich Guthrie is our guest. Rich, give me a quick example of something a bird may like to eat but shouldn't.
Something like hamburger. People, the idea that hamburger is meat and hawks eat meat, Well, hamburger is right up their alley. And the answer is no.
Why? I mean, they'll eat a gopher on this dead gopher that got run over by a car on the side of the road.
More better.
Why? Why is that more better?
Well, because processed meat may have, first of all, it doesn't have all the nutrients ingredients. I mean, hawks do derive some nutrition out of the fur and bones of animals that they eat. I mean, it's in there. And, you know, we're not too much inclined to swallow down some of the bones.
Yeah.
In the, and we kind of look askew when we find chips of bones in things like hamburgers.
I guess it depends on what fast food joint you go to, Rich, because, you know, you'll find some fur occasionally.
Oh, all right. Well, then there you go. We fit that category, too, then.
All right. Listen, let's go to Mass. I believe they're either saying Mass or they're in Massachusetts. Mark, what are you doing right now?
Hello?
Hello, are you on?
Yep, it's me.
Hi, where are you calling from?
Mark in Massachusetts.
Ah, I see. All right, go ahead.
Okay, I got a situation here. Early yesterday morning, I got woken up by a woodpecker attacking my deck outside my bedroom. First time this has happened. The deck's been there for over just about 10 years. Perched on a vertical baluster. It's red cedar. It's been stained. Now, this is the first time, as far as I know, that any bird has attacked my deck. Did a lot of damage in just a few minutes. It was a beautiful bird. I mean, bright red head and maybe even some yellow with a gray breast. And I'm just wondering, I got a theory here, and I'm wondering if it's correct, or either that, or if I'm wondering if the bird was just kind of aimlessly exploring. About at least 2, maybe 3 years ago, I saw some signs of carpenter bee activity underneath a railing. Not the same piece of wood, but it was in the vicinity. But the carpenter bee has been gone for at least 2 or 3 years. And I'm wondering, is it possible that that bee left some kind of traces behind, and maybe that's what attracted the woodpecker, even after all this time?
Well, I would suggest that, yeah, food is probably the cause. And the woodpecker is not going after traces so much as there may still be some action going on inside that baluster. So I would check that out. If the carpenter bees found their way in there may be some other critters that are taking up home in there. So the woodpecker is not inclined to waste their time. They have a way of knowing whether there's a benefit at the end of their work, and that's what they're going to do. They're going to work on that. So
they're not going to aimlessly explore a piece of wood.
No, not likely.
It was a different piece of wood. I mean, this was a vertical baluster. Although the carpenter bee activity was underneath a railing, which was in the vicinity, but you know, maybe a few balusters over, but not
understood.
Not really,
yeah.
Even connected, yeah.
Well, the other thing that, and this is more or less random noise, and that is a woodpecker this time of year will drum on a good resonant piece of wood, usually a hollow branch on a tree or a stump. But if they find something on the side of a house that makes a loud noise when they bang on it, they're going to use that as a drumming sound that they'll create, announcing its territory.
Is this to attract a possible mate? Is that why they do that?
Yeah.
Yes, that, and also to fend off any rivals. So they use that as a territorial song, so to speak. And different woodpeckers have a different technique of drumming, and they all seem to get the message. So it's got to be food, or it's got to be drumming. Aside from that, no, woodpeckers... And other birds really don't have, can't afford to waste their time just poking around.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Rich Guthrie is our guest. It's Birds Today. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number here on Vox Pop. And it's our buddy Joan in Schenectady. Hello, Joan.
Hello, Ray, and greetings, Rich.
Good
to talk to you.
Hello.
Hey. I wanted to update some of our hawk sightings here in the wilderness of Schenectady. I was busy doing some work, and apparently there was a hawk that was also very, very engrossed in what it was, let's say, engorging. And I had to measure when the animal finally flew away. We were about 30 feet away from one another when we discovered each other's presence. So I wanted to just second your comment that I heard earlier, Rich, that when possible, you know, give them their space, especially when they're feeding. And if anybody had any doubts about the power of a hawk beak, I'm a vegetarian, but I still can appreciate there's beings that want meat.
Yeah.
There was not much left. Fur, bone. No, it swallowed everything.
Wow. For a minute, I thought you were going to say the hawk took a chunk out of you, Joan. So I feel much better that you were going in that direction.
I held so still, Ray. I held so still.
Rich.
I think it was a shark shin, Rich. Fairly large. Well, from 30 feet away, it was gigantuan, a large hawk, but real fluffy feathers around the upper thigh, but the bottom part of their leg definitely reminded me of chicken legs.
Okay, well, it does sound like either a sharp-shinned or a Cooper's hawk. Both of them are very near identical in appearance, but one is larger, but there is overlap in size, so you can't go by that. And the chicken leg description sounds like, you know, both of them would fit that bill. The both of them are pretty tenacious. When they're on something, unlike some of the other hawks that will readily flee, the Cooper's and sharp-shinned hawk will stay put and allow somewhat close approach, not too much. And yes, they do clean.
I need to move closer.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Say it again, Joan.
I said, yes, I did not move closer, but I did stay, and I watched a mockingbird hazing it close enough to raise a few feathers, and it just looked at the bird and said, no.
Mockingbirds are like that. They and other birds, if they see one of these hawks in the area, they will give them a hard time. But when a hawk is on a meal, they're pretty reluctant to get off and leave it. It's hard to come by, and they don't want to give it up just too easily. But they have their limits.
Yeah, and I think she came back because I checked later, and what little was left was gone.
Hey, okay. Joan, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Rich Guthrie is our guest. Let's go to Rhinebeck, New York, and Nancy, you're on. Or not. Hello, Nancy.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
This is Nancy. Is that who you're calling?
Oh, my gosh, yes. This is Ray. Nice to meet you.
Yeah. You know, I love your program.
Oh, thanks.
And your bird program, Rich, is one of my very favorite box programs.
He's right
anyway,
here.
Anyway, here's my big question. I live on a beautiful pond in Rhinebeck. And at one point, I counted about 100 Canada geese in the flock. We see lots of Canada geese. Lately, I haven't seen very many. But my big question is, do they migrate or do they not migrate? Because if they don't migrate, then I was teaching misinformation to my kindergartners when I told them that geese and ducks have to migrate or they can't get any food from the frozen pond. But we see a lot of them around here in the wintertime.
Well, to answer your question, yes and no. The Canada goose does migrate and get up to Canada to spend the summer. But there are many of them that stick around all year round. Now, during the nesting season, a pair of Canada geese, or maybe two, it depends on the size of the pond, will settle down and set up a territory, and they will not tolerate any of the strangers in their midst. So they will give them some space, but not allow close approach. So they'll scoot them off, and the bachelors and bachelorettes will wander around from cornfield to pond to river to lake in an incessant just kind of like just cruising. And then some year they'll change their mind and settle down and raise a family of their own. But in the meantime, they're just kind of like being teenagers and bumming around. And but sooner or later they'll take up and set up their own territory and or migrate north to Canada, and where there's plenty of room for them to nest up there as well.
Yeah, well, a year ago we had a blessed event. We one of the geese, she laid eggs, but none of us, my neighbors, none of us saw the babies. I only saw the cracked eggs later. I wonder, were those eggs probably eaten by an animal? Or the babies were eaten, I mean?
Well, it could very well be. They're very vulnerable to predation from things like raccoons or even marauding coyotes and the like. Although the goose will defend its nest and eggs very aggressively, but the other possibility is that the eggs hatched and the goslings wandered off. I don't know if there are any nips and tucks in the pond where they can disappear to, but they're usually pretty conspicuous, and even though they are tiny. So I'm going to guess that, yes, and you can tell a broken egg that was taken by a predator is shattered in so many ways, whereas a hatched-out egg will look like pretty clean halves.
Mm.
Uh-huh. Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's good to know. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I love your show, and I love birds. hearing a
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for calling. We appreciate it. Rich Guthrie is our guest today. It is Birds on the program, and the number is 800-348-2551. Let's grab one or two more here before the next break. And Penny in Del Mar. Hello, Penny.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll make this quick. When do you stop putting the suet out for the birds?
Well, I don't.
Or now, do you?
I do not. I keep it out even through the summer. I will say this. If you got anything that looks like or sounds like or smells like a bear in the neighborhood, don't do that.
I don't. Yeah.
I'm in what I regard as a pretty safe area. And but I do know that folks who are in a more mountainous, more rural, or even in some of the valley locations will have bears marauding their neighborhood. And if that's the case, keep them away. Keep the suet away. Keep the bird seed away. And don't take any chances. Now, when it comes to suet and the like, and I just heard this morning that a friend had a bear rip into her hummingbird feeder. And and the solution there is with the suet or other things is to raise them high up so that the bear just simply can't get to it. And, you know, there are techniques for hanging suet and hummingbird feeders, a rope with a little pulley on it or overhand knot or something like that. We'll get the feeder up and down. But, yes, I keep suet out. The woodpeckers, the chickadees, and nuthatches and the like, they enjoy it. And but if there's any sense, if any of my neighbors talk about a bear in the neighborhood, down these guys come. It's not worth the risk of messing with a bear.
Well, Penny, thank you very much for the call. Rich, let's do one more here, and then we'll take a quick break, and then we'll get your rundown of events coming up in our region, ornithologically speaking. Audrey in Schenectady. Audrey, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I supposed to hang up?
Oh, my gosh. If you hang up, we can't hear you.
Sorry.
Hang in there, Audrey. Hang in there.
Well, I'll make it quick. I have an awning out the back of my house, and the sparrows continually make their nests up there, and we have done everything, put human hair, mothballs. I've called the cooperative extension. I went to Fadigan's, and they still come back.
And that's what they do. And unfortunately, your awning is a very attractive place for either these sparrows or house finches to nest. It's hard to say which, or even starlings. So
it's so messy. It's poop everywhere.
Yeah.
I know. And without seeing the setup, there may be some mechanism that you can use to deter them. But, you know, it sounds to me like they got it all figured out. And what you're doing is just right for them. So they're not going to change. What's got to change is...
Well, I go out with a metal yardstick. And as soon as I see them making a nest, I go out and take it down.
Well, that'll make Rich very happy. What do you think, Rich?
Well, no, there's got to be some compatibility here. And, you know, especially, you know, if it's house sparrows, they can be a nuisance. They're noisy. And as Audrey says, they can be messy.
Yeah.
And if they're interfering with your lifestyle, and you got a case. If you do it soon enough, they'll find.
The cooperative extension told me to put, aluminum pie pans up there.
Yeah.
I did that. Let them swing. They still come back.
Why don't you get a boa constrictor or something and let it go up up there and take care of the birds, right?
Yeah. Without assessing the situation, I wouldn't be able to offer anything more than that. Other than keep trying. I'm really trying to envision what the layout is that is so attractive to the birds that's causing them to be so persistent. And something in that formula is working for them and not for you, that's for sure.
Well, the awning is attached to the back of the house.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, well, okay.
Now, I'm kidding about getting the snake, but, I mean, could Audrey, is there can you get vinegar or something and just put it on the top of the awning? Some kind of natural substance that the birds don't like, Rich?
No, not likely, because, first of all, they don't smell it. It wouldn't be a odoriferous deterrent. But, you know, you hit on something there, Ray, and that is perhaps a rubber snake, an artificial fake snake. Sprawled
up
there.
I even got a big owl and hung it up there.
Oh. The owls don't work. They like to perch on the head of those plastic owls. Snake, that triggers a totally different response. If you could find one of those big green rubber snakes that are out there and try that out, or even a rope to look like a snake.
Yeah.
Give that a go, Audrey, and good luck with that. The prognosis is not good for your happiness.
Thanks, Audrey. We got to take a break here. Rich Guthrie is our guest. We'll get our list of events that Rich, I'm sure, has brewing right now. On the other side of this break, 800-348-2551 is our number. Blades, we'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's Birds Today. Rich Guthrie is here, and as usual, Rich, the lines are completely stacked. We have a pile of email in the email bag, and so let's do your list, and then we'll race through a few emails and then try to get to as many calls as we can.
Okay, Ray. Well, great. Thanks. First of all, I will say that rather than go through the various activities that the clubs are hosting right now, so many of the rules are different from each club to each club because of the whole COVID scene that's still lingering out there.
Yeah.
I will say this, that some of the clubs are restricting their outings, if they're having any whatsoever, to club members or limited to high number of 10, maybe a few more. But check with your local bird club. Go to New York State Ornithological Association to find out what club is in your neighborhood. Over in Massachusetts, Mass Audubon, or the Vermont Institute of Ecosystem Studies, or North Creek Nature Center, can tell you where there's a local club. And you can check their website for the rules of the road for their outings.
Okay.
But I will say this. The Breeding Bird Atlas is up and running and in full swing, and now's the time to get involved in that. And going back to the Whips and Chucks and Nighthawks, I will say that this very night, there's going to be a training session at 7 o'clock that will be focusing on how to do a survey of these birds this summer. And to find out about that, I'm going to direct folks who are interested to Northern New York Birds go to that a Facebook site and check out where they are. You can Google NY Birds and come up with the training session tonight at 7 o'clock, and that's all about how to find nighthawks and nightjars and goat suckers in the field. And one more thing, just for a trip down nostalgia of lane, here's the sound of the whippoorwill and the Chuckwill's Widow. Can we do this, Ray?
Oh, heck yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, here we go. Is that coming across okay?
Oh, it's coming over great.
Great.
Well, where'd you get that?
I got that from eBird.
Oh,
eBird
nice.
Will have that kind of information.
Cool.
And then what I'm going to do is now the sound of the Chuckwill's Widow, and you'll see how they get their name.
Dad?
Let me see. I have to tap this here. Here we go.
Oh, I love that one.
Now, both of those, let me just stop this so we're not listening to them anymore. But both of those occur in our area, surprising or not. The Chuck Wills widow, there's a curious range expansion of these birds, it seems to be, that runs through New York into Massachusetts and down into Long Island and out to Cape Cod.
Yeah.
And so they could occur. And I'm just awareness thing where you listen to these things right after dark. As soon as it gets dark, so dark you can't read the newspaper outside, listen for the whippoorwill and listen for the chuckwill's widow and drive the backcountry roads with the windows down listening for their song. And then let us know.
Yeah.
The Breeding Bird Atlas Project in New York or eBird anywhere else. Or you can email me at richardpguthrie@gmail.com. And I'd love to hear all about them.
I tell you what, that's a good idea. richardpguthrie@gmail.com is your email address. We have about 20 emails here that we will not get to here. We're running.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so okay. I advise all these people to shoot Rich an email. And
yeah, write that down. Keep it handy.
richardpguthrie@gmail.com. You didn't make the sound of the goat sucker.
Yes, I did. The two of those guys are included.
Okay.
And then the Nighthawk, I'll just mention the Nighthawk, and I love the Nighthawks. They used to nest downtown Albany, downtown Pittsfield, Catskill, Saugerties, and Schenectady, but they're no longer around, and it's because the night insects are gone. Remember you used to drive down the road at night and go home, and you're mumbling about all that bug juice that's on the windshield?
Yeah.
You know, you could drive all night long and not have to scrape a single bug off. That's how bad it is, and that's not good.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because and there's one email that I will read here, and this is from Andrew, who says, I disagree. Afternoon, Rich. I've heard you say many times that birds are declining because of a drop in insect population. Even though that's probably true, I have to disagree and say the decline in population is due to decline of habitat. I'm a forester in Massachusetts, and we recognize this problem such that our state has a program called Forestry for the Birds, which we use to educate both foresters and landowners about what they can do to create early successional habitat by managing their woodlots and breaking the even-aged closed canopy system that has overtaken a large portion of bird habitat.
Excellent point. And I thoroughly agree with that 100%. This is a three-legged stool here that's causing the problems. And there are others. There are not only habitat loss here in North America, but also in their wintering grounds, and especially the islands of the Caribbean. And if you're interested in that, Birds Caribbean is a wonderful conservation organization that's working with local governments on the Caribbean islands to protect what remnants of important habitat remain there for not only our birds, but their birds. Our birds spend half the year in those territories. And as wide open as we have, what's left of what we have, it's even more constrained down there. And Central South America and the like.
Mm.
So, yes, that's very, very true. And then there are other causes, such as pesticides and outdoor free-roaming cats and buildings and windows and so many other factors. Bugs are one of them as well.
Fair enough.
I agree with them.
All right, let's grab a few calls here. We have time for maybe four or five at least. Let's go to Lauren in Poughkeepsie. Lauren, you're on.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks, Rich. I need some help with a situation we're having at our house with crows. We have a couple of pairs of crows that are nesting, and what they do in the summer is they rinse off food for their babies that's garbage in our fountain that's in front of our house. And they also hunt baby birds out of our bird boxes, capture those babies, rinse them off in our fountain as well, and leave debris behind. And it's just really a sad situation, and I don't know how to deter these parent crows.
Well, it's a tough call, and the crows have babies, and crow babies need to eat, and mama and papa crow need to find food for their babies, and that's what they do. That's how it works. That's why other birds are so aggressive. If there's a crow in the neighborhood, they will work to drive out the crow to discourage it from being around. And you mentioned that one of the crow species, the fish crow, is particularly fond of the city setting. They've taken up the American crow is the country cousin, but the fish crow a recent arrival, another one of these southerners that have come north, they're quite comfortable in the city, and they know where to find food. They go to the dumpsters behind the donut shop, or they go behind the supermarket and look to see what they can find from scattered, dropped, left-out food. So that's how they work, and they do go after baby birds. That's, you know, part of what they do.
And then they wash their food, though, in water and then bring it to their young?
Sometimes they do.
They come to the fountain with their food?
Soften it up. They learn that, and birds do that. Grackles do the same thing, where they'll take a stale piece of bread and dip it in the water just to soften it and makes it easier for them to ingest it. So, they're pretty smart. It's not hygienic. It's not about hygiene. It's all about softening and moistening and lubricating.
Well, Lauren, thanks a lot for the call. We go to Port Ewan, New York, and Catherine, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question about, I just am new, and I put new to feeding birds, and I put a feeder out a couple of months ago. I got a sweet pair of cardinals. And what's interesting, though, is he's been, any woman would be happy to have a boyfriend like him because he's so attentive to his mate. I've seen him dive bombing blue jays, and, you know, not when the blue jays are amassed, but just one-on-one. It appears like he doesn't want the blue jays near the feeder. And, I mean, yet I've gone online, and this is atypical behavior, isn't it? Because I can't find any, I mean, it's exactly the opposite, where they say blue jays are afraid, or cardinals are afraid of blue jays. But this guy is like, you know, it looks like he's trying to protect the feeder for his girlfriend. Is that true?
Well, actually, what is happening is the blue jay is related to the crow, and they've got some of the crow habits in their lifestyle. And the cardinal has a mate with a nest and babies nearby, and knows the blue jay's bad ways. And so his job is to get that blue jay out of there to protect his babies. The blue jay will steal the eggs or the babies if it can. So he's doing a good protective job of keeping that blue jay at a distance.
So he's always, you know, he's every time there's a blue jay, he turns up, and it's like, I'm watching you.
Yeah.
and I've seen him literally dive bomb a bird that's twice his size. It's really amazing because I've gone online, and I can't find anybody that says they've seen this. They've seen exactly the opposite. But because of it's the breeding season, he's more territorial. Is that it?
Absolutely. And a good observation. And and good for you for going against the grain of the written material.
Catherine, thanks a lot for the call. We go to Jennifer in Pine Bush. Hello, Jennifer. You're on.
Hello. How you doing today, guys?
Good.
All right.
I have a question for you, and I should know the answer to this. I was a wildlife rehabilitator when I was younger, but my kids just recently brought home two baby pigeons that fell out of the, like, 30 feet from the top of an indoor riding arena. So I've been raising them because I know how to do it. But my question is for you, do pigeons home, or are there homing pigeons? Like, what is the difference? Like, if I let these pigeons go in the future, should I let them go where I found them in that horse barn, even though they really don't want them there? Or is it okay to let them go from my property?
Pigeons will adopt a new territory. And if you've been raising them, I'm going to say that these guys have ingrained in them the territory that you have them in now, not the old one.
Okay.
And most birds are homing of some sort. They have a strong fidelity to their nest site or their home site. And so it's not only a realm of pigeons. And certain pigeons show a stronger homing instinct will be the ones that the trainers and the racers and the pigeon messenger carrier people will keep. And the rest of them, they'll find their way back. They're pretty not territorial, but they are faithful to their familiar sites.
Okay, that's fantastic to know. Thank you so much.
Jennifer, good luck with them.
Thanks a lot. Now go to Germantown. And Mimi, you're on.
Hi. Just a quick question about white-throated sparrows. I am seeing them still out there calling, carrying on, and I thought they'd be long gone.
Most of them are. Most of them are. The white-throated sparrow is a bird that nests in Canada and the Appalachian and the Adirondacks.
Right.
And the Catskill Mountains and the Berkshires. And most of them from the lower elevations have moved on. A few of them will linger around. And what's nice about that is they will sing for you before they leave. But sooner or later, they'll all be gone. Pretty sure of that.
Okay. It just seemed to me that they're here very late, and I have quite a lot. I had a bunch at Claremont this morning, and I also had white-crowned sparrow. That was my bird of the day.
Beautiful birds, the white-crowned sparrow, really the aristocrats of the sparrow family.
Oh, they are they? Mimi, thanks for the call. I did not know that. Let's go.
Well, that's how they act. That's how they behave. They have that very proper appearance about them.
Okay. Bernie and Shokan. Bernie, you only have about 30 seconds here.
Yeah, hi. I've got a one-legged gray catbird at my house, and I'm wondering what I can do to help him or her.
Not a thing. And it happens with birds. And if it migrated back on its own, it seems to be doing okay. It's a survivor. It'll have to work it out himself, and it seems to be doing a good job at doing that.
Yeah, he actually looks pretty healthy, but I felt so bad for him, you know?
Yeah, there's quite a few birds that ends up. Their legs are very fragile, and many of the birds can manage to work around it.
Bernie, thanks a lot. We only have a few seconds left. Aaron in Slingerlands. Aaron, you'll be the last one today. Go ahead.
Okay, hi. I have a male cardinal who keeps crashing into our windows. Is there anything we can do to help him? This has been over a month.
That male cardinal is attacking an image of himself, thinking it's another bird. So what you have to do is reduce the image in one way or another. And one way people have been using is to put some sort of a soapy film on the outside of the glass. Sooner or later, it will wash off and the window will be nice and clean. But in the meantime, it will keep the cardinal from seeing its reflection. And there are other techniques. Anything to reduce the reflection, the mirror effect, will work on discouraging that bird.
All right, Aaron, that'll be it for today. Rich Guthrie, once again, how do people find you?
Easy, richardpguthrie@gmail.com. And don't forget ebird.org/atlas New York for the Breeding Bird Atlas Project. ebird.org/atlas New York.
Rich Guthrie, thank you, sir, and we will talk to you real soon, okay?
Excellent, man. Thank you, Ray.
Thanks a lot. Support comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting a new installation in the original art gallery featuring oil paintings by Winslow Homer and other American artists. ArkellMuseum.org. Capital Roots Spring Plant Sale, Saturday, May 15th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., featuring perennials, heirloom tomatoes, herbs, and more. 594 River Street, Troy, supporting essential food access work. CapitalRoots.org. Ollie, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Berkshire Community College, offering summer online classes on China, theater, arts, documentaries, writing, and more beginning May 24th. Learn for the love of learning. BerkshireOLLI.org. At Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 30 years. QFCC.com. Once again, thanks to Rich Guthrie for being here. Thank you for listening. I apologize if we didn't get to your call or email. He'll be back soon. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Dina Salzman. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Talk about a Hall of Fame show. We had birds today. Tomorrow it's gardening. How can you lose? Yeah, you find out at 2 tomorrow.